to what to do, so he rummaged through her handbag to find an address, or a cell phone with a name he could call. He found it peculiar that for a girl her age, she had no phone, but around $400 in cash. 35 minutes after finding a key for the Marigold Motel, Savannah was safely lying on her bed in her room, and fast asleep as Paik made himself at home in an armchair. Chapter 47. Today. Eric rushed back to the hostel from the multi-story car park and managed to slip past the lounge while Nicole and a group of others were preoccupied by something on the television screen. He didn't have the time or the inclination to discover what had them so silently engrossed. Instead, he bolted up the stairs and along the corridor into their dormitory, where he began to rummage through Nicole's suitcase, but as each pocket only yielded socks, underwear, fridge magnets, and postcards Nicole had purchased on their travels, Eric became more and more frustrated.
"Looking for something?"
came Nicole's voice from the doorway. Eric stopped his search, switched on a smile, and turned around.
"Oh, hi, Nicole," he replied chirpily. "Where have you hidden the paracetamol?" "Unzip the top of the backpack, and they're in there with the plasters."
"Cool." By the time Eric found them and turned around to thank her, Nicole had disappeared as quietly as she'd arrived. Chapter 48. Paik didn't question Tommy when a taxi pulled up outside the hostel, and he darted out, grabbing Paik's arm and leading him up the stairs and into room 23.
"How safe is this room?"
Tommy asked breathlessly.
"3 deadbolt locks and a reinforced steel door. I fitted them myself."
"Well, your DIY skills don't inspire me with confidence, what with the number of times you've fallen through the ceiling or electrocuted yourself."
"Do you see anyone else creating a cannabis farm under the noses of 150 unsuspecting people?"
Paik glanced down and noticed 2 large bulging holdalls with the name and logo of a dry cleaner's emblazoned across their sides.
"Don't ask,"
Tommy muttered, his eyes darting around the room. Paik's ability to keep secrets was something Tommy appreciated, and even though he'd yet to discover what made Paik tick, his gut instinct was that the wiry-haired clown had a serious side and could be trusted.
"The room at the back, under the ceiling tiles. Store them there," Paik replied.
Tommy made his way towards the storeroom and used a stool to reach and remove one of the polystyrene tiles, where he placed the bags containing Nicole's cash out of view. As he stepped down, his eyes were drawn to a bathroom beyond the storeroom, separated only by a pane of clear glass. He walked towards it, then took a startled step backwards when he saw Savannah enter. She pulled down her shorts and underwear and sat on the toilet. Tommy remained perfectly still so he wouldn't be spotted, before realizing he was on the other side of a 2-way mirror.
"You okay in there, Tommy boy?" yelled Paik.
And Tommy joined him back inside the room.
"I'll keep your business private if you do the same with mine," Paik added,
and Tommy nodded his agreement. Chapter 49.
"He called me Nicole. In 3 years he's never called me by my full name. So don't ask me how, but I'm sure Eric's found out I know who he is."
Nicole waited nervously for Tommy to finish serving a customer at the hot dog stand.
"You could always admit to what Mrs. Baker left you,"
Tommy asked.
"You get him off your back by splitting the cash."
Nicole pondered his suggestion for a moment, before politely dismissing it.
"I'm not being greedy, but clearly his mum didn't want him to have it. And if he's gone to all this trouble to hide who he is, what else is he capable of doing?"
"Well, that might be a good enough reason to pay him off. If he frightens you, keep yourself safe."
Nicole had left Eric in their dormitory, searching for headache tablets, and gone straight to meet Tommy at their prearranged destination. It explained that while he could have likely got more money if he'd sold the diamonds legitimately, he'd done what she'd asked, and made a decision he thought was right.
It's been a messed up few days,
Nicole continued.
First I discover my best friend's been lying to me about who he is. Then I find his secret mum has left me $500,000 worth of diamonds, and to top it all, the naive girl I shared a room with goes and murders Hollywood's biggest star.
You haven't heard the update, then?
Asked Tommy, tentatively, unsure whether Nicole was ready to hear more bad news.
According to the radio and the taxi, police in Australia reckon she killed her mum and little brother before she came over here.
You're not serious. Am I just the worst judge of character in the world?
It's looking that way,
Tommy joked. But Nicole didn't laugh.
Nah, he added. You've just been bang out of luck.
Nicole let out a long breath and brushed her fingers through her hair.
What the hell is going on, Tommy? I thought this trip was going to be a new start for me. It's turned out to be the worst thing I've ever done.
Tommy didn't know how to respond, so he placed his hand on Nicole's to comfort her, as two middle-aged women approached him.
Three hot dogs, no mustard, just salad,
smiled one, and winked. Nicole was too preoccupied to notice Tommy twice flash three fingers to Jose behind him in the trailer, or see Jose putting three sausages in buns, and then three small bags of pot in each of them. The customer smiled and handed Tommy $50 in return. Moments later, two police officers cycled past and waved at a smiling Tommy.
So how far are you willing to go to take Eric out of the picture?
What do you mean?
I mean, you can't spend much longer living under the same roof as him and avoiding being alone with each other. You need to make a preemptive strike, because if he's cottoned on that you've found what Mrs. Baker's left you and haven't told him, he's going to be mightily pissed off.
I'm worried about him, Tommy,
Nicole admitted, and shuffled awkwardly on the spot.
Actually, I'm terrified to be around him, but you know what?
Above all else, I hate him. I absolutely hate him. And the more I think about his lies, the angrier I get. So over my dead body, is he getting any of that money?
If you need a head start to get away from here, there is a way,
Tommy replied, his brain slowly formulating a plan.
But it's pretty fucking harsh, and it'll cost you about $20,000.
Chapter 50.
How about you?
Savannah asked Jane as they placed their bags of shopping on their beds.
Do you like being in Los Angeles?
I'm falling in love with it, actually,
Jane replied.
I've often toyed with the idea of trying my hand at writing. I even took a course a couple of years ago. I think I have a few stories inside me. Not about me, of course, but there's enough of those woe-is-me-isn't-life-crap memoirs without my contribution. But this city inspires me.
So what's stopping you?
I think I need a permanent base and to set down some roots. I can't really do that in a hostel. It's just a thought. Promise me you'll tell me if I'm being silly here. But what would you think about us finding a place to share together?
I don't know,
Savannah replied, feeling herself flinch. She wasn't at ease, being put on the spot even by a friend, and instantly she questioned if this was part of some plan to get her away from the hostel and on her own. Why else would Jane offer a home to a pregnant pole dancer? But it was almost too tempting.
My baby'll be here in a few months,
Savannah continued carefully.
Do you really want to live with me and a screaming kid?
You have no idea how much I'd like to hear that sound again,
Jane replied wistfully. Savannah felt ashamed of her insensitivity, and watched Jane look away and absent-mindedly fumble with a gold crucifix she wore on a chain around her wrist.
Sorry, I shouldn't have said that,
replied Savannah.
No, no, you didn't say anything wrong. And you're right, darling, it's a daft idea. A young girl like you wouldn't want to live with an old codger like me.
Oh, no, that's not what I meant. It's just that I can only afford somewhere low budget, like above a store or something.
Well, if money's the only thing holding you back, my husband's life insurance means we could afford a little place in West Hollywood. Nothing big, mind. I can cover the rent for at least 8 or 9 months. Maybe he can finally do something good in death that he couldn't do while he was alive.
Savannah was unsure of what to say to Jane. While the offer was undoubtedly kind, relying on someone else for help hadn't been part of her plan. But she was desperate for Jane to be real.
"Well, if you're sure, we could give it a go, I guess,"
she replied, and Jane held her hand out to shake Savannah's.
"What's the deal, then?"
beamed Jane. And Savannah began to tell herself that maybe her fairy godmother had been sent to her for a reason. Chapter 51.
"Hey, lazy bollocks, you missed a hell of a day. Wall-to-wall playboy bunnies, volleyball, silicon and swimsuits. Even if you dreamed it, it couldn't have been better," Declan began as he walked into their room.
Matty didn't respond, and lay on his side facing the wall while Declan covered his burned red face and shoulders with aftersun and continued to boast.
"And get this! I've lined us up a couple of bunnies for tonight. You've got to see them. They're beautiful. Matty! Matty!"
Declan held his breath. When he realized Matty's body had remained motionless, he'd spent many, many hours watching his best friend sleeping and studying his breathing patterns. And this wasn't normal. Slowly, Declan moved towards him and steeled himself. He put his hand on Matty's shoulder and pulled him over onto his back, where Matty remained still, his eyes firmly closed.
"No, Matty, no,"
whispered Declan, placing his panicked fingers on Matty's neck, desperately searching for a pulse. Suddenly Matty's eyes opened and he burst into laughter, while Declan reeled backwards in shock.
"You feckin' idiot!" yelled Declan. "What you do that for? I thought you were... you're...
dead. You can say the word, you know,"
laughed Matty.
"Just think of this as a dry run."
"That's not funny."
Tears streamed down Matty's face as his laughter became uncontrollable. But Declan didn't share his friend's amusement.
"Go fuck yourself," he growled, and stormed out of their room.
Chapter 52. The news of Zack Stanley's death hit Jake with the force of a juggernaut. Feeling suffocated in a lounge crammed full of strangers mourning the image of a man they never knew, he headed towards the open space of Venice Beach and the calming sounds of the waves washing in and out. He slipped out of his flip-flops and waded into the water until he was waist-deep, allowing his breathing pattern to mimic the tide. In and out, slowly, in time with the rhythm of the water, until Jake began to feel calmness return. Zack had been the person who'd known Stuart best, and even though they'd not seen each other since before the night cameras had caught him with cocaine on his lap and a convulsing girl by his side, his death made Jake feel a little more alone. He'd held on to the hope that one day their paths might cross again, and he imagined engineering a reunion by finding out where Zack lived in Los Angeles and turning up on his doorstep so they could close the chapter they'd left unfinished. But it was only ever a daydream. And now Jake would never really know if Zack had tried to find him, because 3 days after making headline news, Stuart's phone and wallet had been discovered lying on the grass by the 500-foot chalk cliffs of Beachy Head. As far as the world was aware, somewhere in the depths of the English Channel, currents were carrying Stuart's body away, never to be found. Meanwhile, a newly born Jake was on the deck of a ferry sailing from Hull to Zeebrugge, Belgium, using a forged passport purchased from his Russian ex-housemates in Bolton. 2 years earlier, Notting Hill, London. Jerry Garland held a keycard to a metal panel on her glossy black front door, which opened automatically. She slipped off her cropped leather bomber jacket and tossed it across a Chesterfield sofa in a large, airy hallway. Stuart and her bodyguards followed her into a drawing room and watched as she poured herself a scotch from a decanter into a chunky glass tumbler, then dismissed them.
"That's good," she purred, taking a long sip. "It's been a hell of a morning, hasn't it, Stu? You know, they say alcoholic drink tastes better in a heavier glass, because the weight of the tumbler can trick the brain in the way it processes taste. But you'd know a lot about tricking people, wouldn't you?
Why'd you sell me out? Stuart blurted out.
Why not?
Jerry replied matter-of-factly.
Why should I sacrifice a whole herd of cash cows when I only need to send one to be slaughtered? But it wasn't my cocaine. You could have helped me convince the papers of that, or come up with an explanation.
An explanation?
Like what? That you'd had an accident with a bag of flour? Don't be so naive.
If it were just photos, then maybe there'd have been a way out, but you were stupid enough to be videoed with it on your lap, on your bloody lap.
They had you banged to rights. But you're not listening to me. It was Katie's coke, not mine. It doesn't matter if it was the Queen of bloody England's coke. It was all over you and a teenage soap star. As far as everyone's concerned, you're the one who killed her. You didn't have to sack me. You could have said you were sending me to rehab. Loads of stars end up at the Priory. I'd have been out within a month and everyone would have forgiven me. Not Katie's parents. Because for the rest of your public life, they'd have hounded you in the press. Look what happened when that lad drowned in Michael Barrymore's swimming pool. He was never allowed to forget that. It destroyed his career, and you'd never be allowed to forget running away when that poor girl was dying next to you. I'm the front man of that group. You told me that yourself. That's why you put me in it. The band can't survive without me.
Band?
You mean brand, because that's all you are. Don't fool yourself into thinking they're going to split up just because of your stupidity. You gave those boys some competition, something to aim for, someone to beat. They've all developed a bit of charisma now, and without you I'm confident they'll step up to the mark.
Stuart swallowed hard. He would not cry in front of her.
Bullshit. I've read the Twitter and Facebook messages, he argued. I know it's me they pay money to hear sing.
Jerry gave a deep, throaty laugh and lit up a menthol cigarette.
Are you now so deluded that you've told yourself you have a voice? She asked. You can't even carry a bloody note. We all know that. That's why we hired a session singer to do all your vocals for you, even the pre-records for the live shows. I give you credit, though. You're the best bloody mime act I've ever worked with. But you're just a pretty face with no talent. Face facts, Stu. You're an experiment to see if the public would buy a silk purse made from a sow's ear. And they did. And you knew that from the word go.
What about you and me? He continued, desperately trying a different tack. I thought we...
add something.
Again, Jerry laughed.
Let's not go there, shall we, son? I don't deserve for it to end like this,
Stuart pleaded.
You didn't deserve a £1 million recording contract either. Or a Canary Wharf penthouse or a Mercedes, but I didn't hear you complaining when you saw the money stack up.
Jerry took a deep drag from her cigarette and inhaled the smoke coming from her mouth with her nose.
You're not getting it, are you, kid?
She continued.
You're a liability. Nobody will touch you with a barge pole in this business again. You had some laughs, you saw the world, you lived like a star. Now, move on.
But
nothing.
Sooner or later you'd have fucked it up for yourself anyway. Katie and I did you a favour. Stuart frowned and chewed the inside of his cheek.
What do you mean, you and Katie did me a favour?
Chapter 53 Day 13 Eric finished flossing his teeth and lifted up his vest, studying his reflection in the bathroom mirror as he rubbed the hairs on his stomach backwards and forwards. He hadn't found the time to manscape in weeks, and was annoyed at himself for allowing things to become so untidy downstairs. He turned to his side and pushed out his stomach as far as it would stretch, then inhaled deeply. He could just about make out his six-pack under a fatty layer of convenience food, sugary soda drinks, and a recently acquired penchant for blueberry muffins. He vowed he'd have all the time in the world to get back into shape once his mission was complete, and he predicted this would be very soon once he worked out what Nicole was up to. Now she was aware of who he was and had greedily unearthed his mother's legacy without telling him. The playing field was level, and the game could begin in earnest. It was a game he'd win, of that Eric was sure, and he knew the chickens were coming home to roost a decade after they'd been thrown from the family nest. someone who'd had little regard for the well-being of people in general, even Eric was aware of the irony of choosing a nursing career. After a handful of expulsions from the country's top private schools, he'd scraped his way through 5 GCSEs and scratched a living from part-time jobs as a casino croupier and call center worker before joining the healthcare industry. It was a career he planned would take him around the world once he branched out into the private sector, as that's where the real money lay. Palliative one-to-one care for the wealthy and terminally ill meant he could earn more in the space of a month than in a year with the NHS. But with 2 more years of experience still required and his current earnings basic, Eric found a lucrative sideline through a single and needy hospital pharmacist who fell easily for his flattery. Soon after their first tryst, he'd had her keys copied and replaced inside her handbag, without her being any the wiser, and not long after she'd turned on the closed sign and gone home for the night, Eric was like a child with a free night pass to Toys R Us. He'd had contacts willing to pay handsomely for past their sell-by date drugs before the pharmacist denatured them or sent them off to an incinerator. He'd also pocket empty order chits while his patsy was otherwise engaged. Frequently, Eric slipped Alzheimer's, dementia, and comatose patients vitamin tablets or placebos instead of their regular medication, believing it made no difference to their well-being what tablets they took. They were doomed anyway. Those pills also sold well on the black market. But while his extra earnings gave him a higher standard of living, it wasn't enough for Eric. Now Nicole held the key to how he should be spending the rest of his life. Eric exhaled and let his belly expand, pulled his vest down and steeled himself for his next performance with Nicole. As he opened the bathroom door, he saw her hovering around her bed looking nervous, before she turned in his direction.
"I'm heading out for a bit," Nicole said.
"Where are you going?" Eric asked, with a painted smile.
"To the chemist's,"
Nicole replied and smiled back at him.
"You used the last of the paracetamol. I won't be long."
As she left the room, Eric knew he'd been lied to, as he hadn't taken any medication. He glanced suspiciously at their bunk beds, and at first couldn't put his finger on why they looked different. Then he noticed Nicole had uncharacteristically tidied up around her bed. Her clothes and empty bags were no longer scattered across the floor. Her sheets and pillow were in place, but her sleeping bag was nowhere to be seen. Neither was her suitcase, he thought. He checked under her bed to see if she'd stored them there, but the space was empty. He went towards the locker area where Nicole sometimes kept her belongings. But there was no trace of her. "She's running away," he realized, feeling his rage rise. Immediately, he located his toilet bag and rifled through it, shoving something into the pocket of his jeans. Then he ran down the corridor after her. Chapter 54. Tommy anxiously drummed his fingers on the reception desk, turning his head to check the clock above Ron's office for the second time in a minute. A full day had passed since he'd last seen or spoken to Jake. But Nicole's troubles gave him more cause for concern than Jake's unexpected outburst at the karaoke bar. And while Tommy didn't hold grudges, he'd quietly hoped Jake would have sought him out to apologize by now. Meanwhile, Savannah perched on a stool behind Tommy and placed spacers between her toes, painting her nails in a deep red. He looked jittery, she thought, but she didn't ask why. Every so often she felt twinges in her stomach, so she'd gently rub her belly in a clockwise motion, as if to reassure her baby all was well in the outside world that awaited him. She hoped it wasn't a surge of hormones heightening her emotions or preventing her from thinking rationally. But she had a hunch that moving in with Jane was the right thing for all concerned. No matter how much she mulled it over, she just couldn't find fault with Jane. And it was too difficult to resist the offer to live under a proper roof with someone experienced in motherhood to help guide her in those first few difficult weeks. She knew she must put her child's welfare above her own pride.
Yes, she told herself. I've made the right decision.
Because sometimes trusting a stranger could be the right thing to do. 4 months earlier, cafe, Los Angeles. Paik made the most of the all-you-can-eat waffle bar and brought a third full plate back to the table he shared with Savannah. She wore dark sunglasses to shield her eyes from the bright light that added to the haziness of her memory. She poured several spoonfuls of sugar from the dispenser into her second mug of black coffee and gingerly sipped it.
"Do you know what happened last night?" asked Paik.
Savannah shook her head.
"I remember feeling dizzy when I was getting changed, and I blacked out, but I don't know how long for. And I know something doesn't feel right, you know, down there. What if he did something to me?"
"I can take you to the police, if you like. You know, get you examined."
"What's the point? I don't know what it feels like to be assaulted in that way, but I'm sure I'd be in a lot more pain if I had been. And I've showered so there wouldn't be any evidence left."
"What if he knows where you live?"
"You're not helping me feel better about this."
"I'm serious. I know somewhere in Venice you can stay. That won't cost you anything. You'll be surrounded by people, so you'll be safe. And I know a guy who works on the door at the Pink Pussycat in Santa Monica who could get you work, so you wouldn't have far to travel."
Savannah looked at Paik and realized that under the strangest of circumstances, and despite not knowing a thing about him, this was the first friend she'd made since she'd arrived in the city. 2 hours later, she found herself standing in the doorway of a room at the Venice Beach International Hostel. Inside were 2 single beds, 2 lockers, and a bathroom with a sink, toilet, shower, and a large mirror on the wall.
"It's the best room we have,"
began Paik apologetically, sensing Savannah's disappointment.
"But you'll have it to yourself most of the time. I'll make sure Ron only puts people in here if we are busy."
"It'll be fine. Thanks again, Paik."
"Oh, and take this,"
he added, and passed her something from his jacket pocket.
"A gun?"
Savannah replied, taken aback.
"It's for your protection."
"Well, I didn't think you wanted me to rob a bank with it."
"Do you know how to use it?"
"Of course. Doesn't mean I feel comfortable with it, though."
Paik closed the door behind him and left Savannah to acclimatize to her new surroundings. While her motel room was basic, it was still expensive, and Paik offered this accommodation for free. If she worked hard at the new club that Paik suggested, it would enable her to save up and afford something better. Savannah looked at the gun and went to put it in the locker, but hesitated and placed it inside her handbag instead. She began to unpack her clothes and hang them up on the rails, and placed her many cosmetics on a shelf in the bathroom. And she was unaware she was already being watched from a room behind the bathroom mirror. Today, Tommy and Savannah's silence was broken by Nicole, who rushed past them out the front door, glancing over her shoulder towards Tommy, who responded with a nod. 30 seconds later, Eric walked briskly past him in the same direction as Nicole, and Tommy sprang into action.
"Sav, can you hold the fort here for a few minutes? I won't be long."
"Sure, honey. Is everything okay?"
But before she got her answer, Tommy was out of the door and running towards the beach. Chapter 55. Nicole picked up her pace as she made her way towards the second floor of the car park where their pickup truck was. She was not alone, and it took all her strength not to just turn around and stand her ground and confront the urgent footsteps making their way up the concrete ramp behind her. But that wasn't part of the plan, yet. Finally, the Chevy was in view. She reached into her pocket and removed a bunch of keys, looking down to find the one that opened the door. But before she could find it, she was pushed hard from the side and fell to the floor. Her cheek and wrist took the brunt of the impact, but she was too distracted by the snarling face looking down at her to feel pain.
Clumsy.
Eric smiled. Chapter 56. Tommy's eyes darted in all directions until he caught sight of the two people he'd left the hostel to find. He half walked, half jogged until they were a few meters away from him, but just as he prepared to approach them with his rehearsed spiel, Jake blindsided him.
"Hey, stranger. I've been looking for you. Where are you heading in such a hurry?"
"Oh, hi,"
began Tommy, his eyes flitting between Jake and his targets. As much as he wanted to talk to Jake and discover what had made him lose his temper at the King's Head pub, now was not the time.
"So what have you been up to?"
"Oh, just been busy at the hostel, you know."
"Okay,"
replied Jake, unsure of Tommy's reticence to converse.
"Everything all right? You seem a bit distracted."
"Look, Jake," continued Tommy, "I'm really sorry, but I'm kind of in the middle of something right now. Can we catch up later?"
"Yeah, sure," Jake replied.
But Tommy had hurried away before he finished his sentence. Chapter 57. Nicole lifted her head from the car park's concrete floor and struggled to focus her eyes on Eric.
"You pushed me,"
she muttered, taken aback by his sudden violence.
"You've been pushing me for days, Nicole,"
Eric replied. His imposing figure stood over her, arms folded in defiance.
"Now let's cut to the chase, shall we? Where are they?"
"Where are what?"
"Don't play stupid. Where are my mother's diamonds?"
"I don't know anything about any diamonds,"
Nicole replied, and clambered to her feet. But she wasn't fast enough to shield her nose from the brunt of Eric's headbutt, and she dropped back to the floor, clutching her face and howling. Eric let out an exaggerated sigh, then kicked her in the stomach. Nicole's eyes opened wide as she fought to breathe. She'd expected their confrontation to be verbally unpleasant and threatening. But she'd never seen this Eric before. "Nicole, you were stupid enough to leave a diamond in the car, along with Maria's note." Now it made sense to her, how Eric knew about her discovery. She thought she'd covered her tracks, and her mind raced as she tried to settle on a reply, but as she struggled to get to her feet, Eric kicked her again.
"Okay, so we'll do this the hard way,"
he continued. And as Nicole fell to her side, he climbed on top of her, rolled her onto her back, and pinned her arms and legs down with his own. Then, from the back pocket of his jeans, he pulled out a small bottle with a clear liquid inside and a syringe. He jabbed the bottle's membrane and drew the liquid up the barrel.
"What are you doing?"
gasped Nicole.
"I'll give her credit. My mother put up a good fight for a weak woman. Are you going to do the same?"
Eleven weeks earlier. London. The digital display on the medical monitor next to Mrs. Baker's bed read 4:45 a.m. when she woke to find someone replacing a syringe driver into her chest.
"Is that you, Nicole?"
she asked groggily, and struggled to recognize the figure hovering over her. She felt cold breath against her ear when he spoke.
"Hello, Mum,"
whispered Eric. To Mrs. Baker's horror, he held his face inches away from hers.
"What have you done with my inheritance?"
Mrs. Baker felt her heart racing, and her eyes began to water, but she would tell her estranged offspring nothing.
"You know my sister doesn't need it,"
he continued, his voice growing louder. "And after what you put me through, it's rightfully mine, so tell me what I'm getting and where to find it." Mrs. Baker trembled, but again refused to talk. Suddenly Eric had a thought.
"She knows, doesn't she?
You've told Nicole." When Mrs. Baker's mouth twitched and her pupils dilated, Eric knew he was correct. "Once again you choose a stranger over your own flesh and blood, well, you won't make that mistake again." When she turned her head to look away from him, Eric clamped his hand over her mouth. He felt the loose skin on his mother's arms brushing against his own as she attempted to bat his hand away. But she was too weak to hurt him or to shout for help. Eric shook his head. "You are, and always have been, a stupid, stupid woman." Eric maneuvered his other hand towards the syringe driver and plunged the needle into it. In less than a minute, a massive overdose of morphine left Mrs. Baker dead. Eric took in a deep breath, exhaled and smiled, then stretched his arms above his head and yawned.
"Looks like we'll need Nicole after all," he said.
He turned to face his sister Bridget, who sat in the corner of the room and nodded.
You didn't give her much of a chance to reply.
"She was never going to tell me," Eric added, "so it was quicker to cut out the middleman." Bridget picked up her coat from the arm of her chair and walked towards the door. "And remember," added Eric, "cremation, not burial. Today." It was one thing for Nicole to learn that her best friend was a liar, and then to be a victim of his vicious nature once he was provoked. But to hear Eric admit he murdered his own mother because she wouldn't tell him what he wanted to know horrified her. She kept a hold on her nerves to keep him talking and to play for time.
"Why?"
asked Nicole.
"She was going to die soon anyway."
"Why not?" shrugged Eric. "She gave me life and then destroyed it, so I took hers away from her. It's only fair."
"Of course it's not fair. You could have just gone to her house while she was in hospital and searched for the diamonds yourself."
"I didn't know if her housekeeper would recognize me from any old photographs knocking around the place. And if she had, it would have got a lot messier. You're starting to understand the lengths I'll go to get what I'm owed."
"But you aren't owed anything."
"And Saint Nicole is. Just because you befriended a terminally ill, vulnerable old widow, you're the same manipulative bastard I am."
"You killed your own mother for nothing. You're evil."
"For nothing, is that what you really think?" Eric threw his head back and laughed, but his smile quickly faded. "Let me tell you something about your wonderful friend Grace Baker, Nicole. When you're a 9-year-old boy who's being repeatedly raped by your housemaster at one of the top boarding schools in the country, when you turn to the one person for help who should believe you, your mother, when that one person says it's in your imagination and you're lying because you're homesick, when you beg and plead and then beg and plead some more, and you even try to hang yourself with a bedsheet from the wooden beams of the school refectory because you can't take it anymore, when that one person's response is to remove you from that school and shove you into another one without even allowing you a visit home, when you kill that person, it is not for nothing. It's called karma. And as you're about to discover, what they say is true. Karma is indeed a bitch." The manner in which Eric's story tripped off his tongue without pause or hesitation gave Nicole no doubt he was telling the truth. She didn't want to believe that Mrs. Baker could have been so dismissive of her son's plight, and it certainly didn't excuse Eric's subsequent actions, but the part she had played in creating the monster currently pinning her to the floor could not be denied. Eric hadn't planned to tell her anything about his past, but when he witnessed a slight softening in Nicole's eyes, it only angered him more. "Do not feel sorry for me," he ordered, "when it's your own safety you need to be worried about." He jabbed the needle into Nicole's arm as she twisted her body from side to side in an attempt to throw Eric off her. "Just a little more pressure, and the morphine will reunite you with both of our mothers very soon. Now for the last time, where are my diamonds?" Nicole's breathing became sharp and desperate. She had completely underestimated his determination and how much he hated her, and glanced around the empty car park, willing someone to disturb them. "In the air vent," she finally declared,
I found them in the air vent in the truck.
I've already looked in there.
I know. That's why I put them back there an hour ago. I thought it'd be the last place you'd look again.
Eric stared into each of Nicole's eyes, searching for a telltale sign she was lying.
Ha! Clever, he conceded.
Then removed the needle, yanked her to her feet, and shoved her towards the vehicle. Open it, he barked, pointing to the door.
Try to run, and I will kill you.
Nicole unlocked the truck, opened the passenger door, and leaned inside to pull the air vent out. But it was jammed. She jabbed her fingers between the plastic strips and yanked hard, but nothing moved. Impatiently, Eric pushed her to one side and with two big tugs, pulled the unit from its casing. Nicole made a couple of tentative steps backwards, but when Eric stopped her, she stopped. He shoved his hand inside the vent, felt around with his fingertips, and pulled out a small velvet pouch. He turned to look at Nicole and grinned. Chapter 58.
You're a bloody idiot, Stuart,
Jake told himself as he watched Tommy run off up the boardwalk. He quickly realized his mistake and couldn't remember the last time he'd referred to himself using his former persona. He wondered if it was spending too much time with Tommy that caused his slip-up, because there was something infectious about Tommy's wide-eyed vulnerability that reminded him of himself before he'd allowed fame to corrupt him. And Tommy also had a quality about him that made Jake want to be completely honest about who he was and who he used to be. Up until moments earlier, when Tommy brushed him off, he'd even considered broaching the truth with him. But today's meeting was a reality check, because Jake understood Tommy was never going to want anything but friendship from him, and he hated his cliched behavior in falling for a straight man he could never have. Nah, he thought, and decided against placing his deepest, darkest secrets upon Tommy's shoulders. Tommy was probably moving on from their friendship anyway, because friendships made in hostels were transient, and in his experience that was the case with all his relationships.
2 years earlier, Notting Hill, London.
What do you mean you and Katie did me a favor?
Stuart repeated slowly. Jerry stared at her fallen protege, briefly wondering if it would be better to backtrack rather than admit the truth. She decided against it.
What do you think it means? She snapped. Pretty self-explanatory, sweetheart. You set me up. You got Katie to put those drugs on my lap just as we arrived at the hotel. That's pretty much the bare bones of it. Let's not forget tipping off the Paps on your arrival. But I didn't expect her to shove so much of that shit up her nose that it'd kill her. Typical of Katie, though, wasn't it? She took dying for fame too literally. But why?
A stunned Stuart replied.
I didn't do anything to you.
Jerry laughed.
Why? Why not? Because I bloody can.
And you're right, you didn't do anything to me, but you were quite happy to do a lot to Zach Stanley. Stuart glared at Jerry, unsure of how to respond. Nobody, bar Zack's sister, was supposed to know of their relationship.
Don't think there's a single aspect of your life I don't know about, Stewie.
Jerry continued smugly.
I know about your little liaisons with the Hollywood hunk. I know you're not pure as the driven snow when it comes to using illegal substances in the bedroom. In fact, I even have video footage of you two indulging in your sordid sex and coke romps. Which is why you're going to keep your mouth shut about everything that's been said in this room, because if I hear one word publicly from you, my footage is going to mysteriously leak online. And how much more humiliation can you take in 24 hours? If you do that, Stuart stuttered, then I'll tell the press about the miming, your secret tax shelters, how you and Katie set me up. Are you really to blame for her death? You'll be ruined.
And then I'm going to vehemently deny it before suing the arse off you, as you signed a non-disclosure agreement when I let you into my band, and it's valid for 5 years after you leave or are thrown out. I've got you over a barrel, sweetheart. A position, if I recall correctly, that you're quite fond of.
Stuart stepped backwards.
reeling from the storm of threats and revelations Jerry was raining down upon him.
"You did all of this because I wasn't interested in you?"
he asked hesitantly.
"Like I said, it's simply because I can."
"No, there's more to it than that."
"Well, I guess you can throw ratings into it, too. The new series starts in a month, and everyone's going to be watching to see who'll be the next wannabe to fuck up."
"You bitch.
I'll give you that. You're perceptive. Now, if you don't mind, it's been lovely catching up, but I have a meeting with a young lad who'll do anything, or more precisely, do me to replace you."
Suddenly, anger, frustration, adrenaline, and the drugs powering through Stuart's nervous system connected in an angry alliance Stuart had never experienced before. Without thinking, he sprinted towards Jerry, dragging her to the ground and clasping his hands around her neck. Twice he smacked her head against her parquet flooring, before her security staff heard the commotion, dashed in and pulled him off her. One held Stuart's arms behind his back as the other punched him twice in the stomach and once in the face. A stunned Jerry struggled to her feet and steadied herself with a trembling arm on the drinks cabinet. She coughed and spluttered, and her throat hurt, but she was still able to find her voice.
"I rescued you from Holiday Inn Hell! I made you a star! And even after I ruined you, I still own you, you little prick!"
she bellowed.
"And I will destroy you unless you get the fuck out of my house!"
Stuart struggled in vain as he was hauled out of Jerry's drawing room and into the hallway.
"You can't get away with this!" he hollered. "Already have, sweetheart. Already have,"
replied Jerry, before pouring herself another glass of scotch. Jerry's security men were too preoccupied with ejecting him from the hallway to notice what he'd swiped from a sideboard. Chapter 59 Today. There were many things that terrified Nicole about Eric in a short space of time. None more so than the look of greed and victory spreading across his face as he held the pouch of diamonds in the palm of his hand. Eric had killed once to get what he wanted, and she was convinced he would kill again. Her entire body trembled as she looked around for an escape route.
"I presume you've had them valued?" he asked.
"How could I? You never let me out of your sight," Nicole lied.
"Your boyfriend could have done it for you. Remind me to pay little Tommy a visit before I leave."
Eric poured the contents of the pouch into his hand. But before he could stop her, Nicole leaped into action. She lurched towards him and slapped the underside of his hand, spraying the gems across the car park floor. Then, gambling on Eric choosing greed over revenge, she ran as fast as her legs could carry her towards the exit. Nicole's hunch proved correct, as behind her Eric hesitated, at first unsure of which way to turn before dropping to his hands and knees, frantically grabbing all the glistening jewels he could see. He scooped them into his pocket and stood up, but as his right foot moved forward, he felt a crunching under his sole. He looked down to see a tiny fragment of shattered glass. And suddenly reality began to dawn upon him. He took out one of the diamonds from the pouch, placed it on the floor, and trod on it. It, too, left a powdery residue.
"Costume jewelry,"
he snarled, and pulled the syringe out of his pocket.
"You're dead, Nicole!"
he yelled at her fading, running footsteps, and turned around to pursue her.
"Put the syringe down, sir,"
came a stern female voice from nowhere. Eric quickly turned his head to see two uniformed police officers, their pedal bikes by their side. Eric's mind raced as this had not been part of his plan, albeit a plan that had been altered the moment Nicole cleared out her belongings from their room. However, it had clearly been part of Nicole and Tommy's.
"This isn't anything,"
he began and walked towards them, smiling. The officers quickly reached for their guns and pointed them at him.
"Put the weapon down, sir,"
shouted the officer.
"Guys, guys," said Eric, panicking. "This isn't a weapon. I'm diabetic. This is insulin."
Eric dropped the needle, and while one officer covered her partner, the other pushed Eric against the side of the car, patted him down, and handcuffed him. It says morphine here. The first officer began, reading the label on the bottle he plucked from Eric's pocket. Doesn't say anything about insulin.
I can explain that, stuttered Eric. I'm going to look in the vehicle,
the second officer added, and radioed for assistance.
You need a warrant, said Eric nervously. Everything in there is rightfully mine.
Everything in this car is rightfully yours, you say? Asked the second officer, removing tarpaulin from the flatbed of the truck and looking underneath.
Yes,
replied Eric nervously. In the back of the truck was Nicole's suitcase. But as the officer unstrapped the buckles and opened it, its only contents were 5 brick-sized packages of shrink-wrapped cannabis resin. Eric looked aghast as a patrol car made its way up a ramp and onto their level.
That's got nothing to do with me, he protested.
But his words fell on deaf ears as he was read his rights and bundled into the back of the police car. Chapter 60 Nicole sprinted down 3 fire exits and 2 ramps out of the car park and across the road to the safety of a bustling sidewalk. She ran past the hostel and towards the beach, passing a parade of shops before she stopped behind a van parked outside a restaurant. She crouched down, struggling to catch her breath. Her head, stomach, and nose ached, and her mouth felt dry before she was struck by an overwhelming urge to vomit. Last night's Chinese food hit the ground before she heard a disgusted muttering, and turned around to discover she was being watched by diners eating on a restaurant patio just meters away from her. However, disapproving stares from strangers were the least of her worries. Nicole waited nervously until she saw headlights appear from the car park exit and a police vehicle leave. She stood up and squinted at the rear of the vehicle and briefly made eye contact with Eric before he was driven out of sight. Chapter 61
He could have killed you,
began Tommy, as Savannah wiped away grit and dried blood from Nicole's forehead and nostrils. Nicole lifted up her T-shirt and tentatively felt her ribs. None were broken, but she was quite sure they were bruised. Her nose was, however, broken, and she realigned it herself with a crack and a yelp before it had time to heal crookedly. Savannah'd been keen to help when Tommy and Nicole turned up at her door looking for somewhere quiet to clean up and regroup, and she used cotton wool buds from Jane's first aid kit to clean a wound on Nicole's chin and cheek.
"Why didn't you let me come with you if you thought he might be that dangerous?"
continued Tommy.
"He wouldn't have followed both of us, so I had to go on my own. And if you'd been with me, who'd have approached the police on the beach? What did you tell him? That someone had been selling drugs to hostelers from a pickup truck, and I'd just seen him in the car park. What's Eric been charged with?" I didn't understand all the technicalities, but when I called pretending to be his sister, Bridget, to ask about bail, they said something about an intent to supply drugs and possession of a potentially lethal weapon. The truck's been impounded, and because it was shipped over here and registered in his name, there's no link to me. I can't drive, so I'm not even named on the insurance.
Why didn't you tell police what he did to his mom?
Asked Savannah.
Because it's Eric's word against mine. Mrs. Baker was cremated, so they can't do any toxicology tests on her body. And there's no way Bridget will ever admit to being party to her mother's murder.
Nicole sighed and rubbed the tears pooling in the corner of her eyes.
If what he was saying about Mrs. Baker not believing he was being abused is true, then I feel terrible for him, but I did the right thing, didn't I?
I don't think you had much of a choice,
Tommy replied softly.
And don't forget, you're a wealthy woman now. What you can do with the money?
I've not really had time to think about it,
sniffed Nicole.
I might stay in L.A. for a while and get my head together.
Nicole held her hand out and placed it on Tommy's.
Thank you, by the way. It's good to know who your friends are.
Only Savannah noticed how tense Tommy's hand became in response. Before he removed it and began picking up bloody cotton wool buds from the floor, dropping them into a bin. Just 2 weeks ago, Tommy could only have hoped for a moment of closeness like that. But a lot had happened in that short space of time. Yet he wasn't ready to admit to himself that there was someone else he was developing much stronger feelings for.
"Oh, yeah?"
added Savannah.
"Where did you come up with $20,000 worth of pot so quickly?"
Ron admitted he wasn't a man to express his emotions freely. He couldn't recall the last time he'd cried. He'd fallen in love just once in his 68 years, and the only thing that made him laugh were video clips of dogs doing silly things on YouTube. He couldn't remember the last time something or someone had left him speechless. So when Tommy walked into his office, placing $19,000 in $100 bills on his desk, his mouth dropped before he'd even realized.
"Tell Pike he needs to speed up production,"
was all Tommy said before leaving him to count the cash. And as he made his way up the stairs, Tommy decided neither Ron nor Nicole needed to know about the $1,000 he'd anonymously pushed under Matty and Declan's door that afternoon. Chapter 62
"Man, I really need this,"
said Tommy, taking a long drag from a joint.
"I didn't think you approved of my relaxation methods," asked Paik.
"I need to start lightening up a bit."
"No shit."
Paik was a little surprised when Tommy turned up at the door of room 23, asking for something to help him chill out after a stressful day. He rolled Tommy a spliff with just a little cannabis to get him used to the taste, and they sat on either side of the windowsill, looking out of the only pane of glass not covered by a blind or cardboard. The condensation from the heat lamps meant the window's coverings needed replacing every couple of days, or they'd turn to papier-mâché. Tommy's head was already feeling like candy floss when he pointed towards Joe, sleeping on a discarded mattress in an alley dumpster below.
"I wonder how it all went wrong for him,"
Tommy asked.
"Have you ever taken the trouble to ask him?"
"I guess not. I just wondered why he started making such bad choices."
"Are any of the choices we make the right ones?"
"Man, can we have just one conversation without this weird cryptic shit?"
"Nope,"
smiled Paik.
"You're never curious why Joe's life is such a waste."
"Who are you to judge him? Just because he hasn't got what you have doesn't mean he's wasted it."
"Come on, nobody knows who he is. He's got no money, no home, no family, not even a roof over his head. Nobody deserves that."
"But the man can live without all those things. And you have more in common with him than you think.
Please enlighten me, O wise oracle."
"Neither of you has any freedom."
Tommy frowned. "Well, that's bollocks, because I'm not the one scratching around for money, my whole life dedicated to scoring my next fix."
"That's true, but while he has no freedom from his addiction, you are not free from the limits you set yourself. You are one of the most uptight, frightened little shits I've ever met. You've come traveling to escape something. That's pretty clear to anyone. Then you separate from your friend, you end up here, and you don't have the balls to go anywhere else on your own. You hide, safely entrenched in the margins, never in the middle of the page. You're too scared to embrace freedom. You're like a fish in a bowl in the ocean looking out towards the big picture, but always too gutless to make the jump."
"Fuck you and your dumbass similes,"
snapped Tommy, taken aback by Paik's character assassination.
"Where's all this coming from? You don't know the first thing about me."
"Tommy boy," continued Paik, exasperated, "I've met people like you countless times, and you are all the same. You are tourists, not travelers. You design your own problems, then you bitch when no one gives you the solution."
"No, I don't."
"Be honest with yourself, if not me. You have remained here in this hostel because it's the safest, most convenient option. You are scared of going home, scared of what to do with your life, scared of what you are feeling for Jake."
"Jake's a mate,"
interrupted Tommy, sounding less than convincing.
"He's more to you than that, and you know it. You think he's found what you've been looking for. You think he's at peace with himself. You think he is everything you want to be, but are too scared to find by yourself, so you live vicariously through his anecdotes, hanging on his every word. But he's not any of those things, Tommy. He's a man, and men are flawed, some more than others. You can't live your life through someone like that.
You owe yourself more. Tommy folded his arms defiantly, his partially stoned mind racing, desperately trying to justify his choices and devising a counter-argument.